Chapter 32. Papara. McNab and Chief Varua were walking down to the water's edge as the outrigger, carrying Thomas, swept over the coral reef and slid up onto the beach. Thomas stepped out onto dry land and turned to thank the two young men who had whisked him up the coast to Papara in under an hour. He'd been impressed by the speed and stability of the single outrigger canoe, with its canted mast and crab claw sail that could be easily tilted and rotated to best work the wind. Compared to the 8-hour horseback ride through mountainous terrain he and Boswell had made several days ago, the canoe trip had been an exercise in pure luxury. Two small children raced down the beach and ducked behind the chief's legs before scooting off towards the cook shack, where a dozen women were working over coal-fire ovens and bubbling copper pots.
"Welcome, Colonel," said Varua with an expansive smile. "To be honest, few of my people thought that you would accept our invitation to the games."
The knife through the printed fabric routine had more the feel of a royal summons than an invitation, Chief Varua, Thomas responded. "Regardless, I am happy to be here, and I am looking forward to watching the competitions. Monsieur Aubert says there is nothing quite like them in the entire world."
"Ah, but you shall do much more than observe, my dear Colonel," said Varua. "Captain McNab has extolled the courage and skill you displayed during your war of rebellion, and we are anxious to see you engage our warriors in Tahitian sport."
Before Thomas could reply, Varua turned to speak to a woman who was carrying a basket of smoked fish. Thomas raised his eyebrows and looked at McNab, but the captain merely shrugged his shoulders and motioned towards the village's central compound, where preparations for the opening of the games that evening were well underway. Young women and children were wrapping posts with colored bunting and fresh leaf garlands. Others were chalking lines around palms that would be used for javelin throwing, and two boys were hammering a line of sharp-tipped steel poles into the ground for the coconut husking competition. Down the beach, a group of men were checking the sails and paddles on a dozen outrigger canoes that would slip into the ocean just after dawn for the grueling 36-mile race up the coast of Papeete and back. The smell of savory pork roasting in underground clay ovens, mixed with the aroma of fresh baked bread under the cloudy sky, as they took seats at a small stone table. A young boy and girl brought them a tray of fruit and a small loaf of bread still hot from the oven, along with a bowl of honey butter and two mugs of coffee. Thomas sipped his coffee thoughtfully.
"We need to talk about these games," he said, "especially about the wrestling. I have no intention of going into the ring with A'ata or anyone else, for that matter. And as for a fight to the death, that's a damn fool idea."
McNab lowered his cup and smiled.
"A lot of assumptions are rolled up in that statement, my friend. No doubt, Aubert suggested that you and A'ata would play the role of Warren Titans for the amusement of one and all."
Thomas was about to respond when Keani and a friend rounded a hut and walked in his direction. Keani made eye contact with him, smiled, and tilted her head slightly to one side as she passed. She slipped by so close that he caught scents of lilac and ripe strawberry. He realized he was holding his breath when McNab poked him in the ribs and said,
"And that, Colonel, is exactly the kind of thing that is going to get you crippled or killed. Take your pick."
"It was just a smile."
"No, it was an invitation, and Lord knows how many people just saw what happened."
McNab leaned back and dug a pipe and tobacco pouch from his pocket. When it was lit, he said,
"I'm no gambler, but I bet that within the hour, you will be receiving an emissary from the great A'ata. The gauntlet is about to be thrown down on you, Thomas, and it will not be an invitation to play a game of cricket."
I can refuse to accept, said Thomas.
And do what? Go where? The island isn't that big, lad. A'ata was already humiliated by Keani's refusal to marry him before you arrived, and now she is practically throwing herself at the first American soldier she meets. Ooh, he is going to have his honor restored, whether you choose to willingly participate in the games or not.
Thomas set down his coffee and watched the gentle waves roll on shore. In his mind's eye, he saw his desk in the Chronicle newspaper office and the candlelit dining room of Kwan's restaurant. He felt himself flying off the deck of the König Wilhelm and splashing into the iridescent lagoon with Princess Noelani. He galloped on horseback across his sugar plantation, saw the face of the leper who cared for him on Molokai, and watched as Akoni slipped beneath the crashing surf when their little boat was smashed on the rocks. Fitch Donegan fired at him through the door of the Pearl, and a great whale breached the surface of the water beside his schooner. So much had happened since he stole the tiny dinghy and rowed out into the freezing waters of San Francisco Bay 6 months ago, and at every step along the way, he was running from someone or something, perhaps even from himself. He took a deep breath, pushed away from the table, and stood up. "I have done no wrong to A'ata or to any man here," he said to McNabb. "But if he comes for me, I will meet him head on." McNabb looked into Thomas's eyes and saw that he was completely at ease with his decision.
"I'm sure you will," the captain thought to himself. "God help A'ata should it come to that."
McNabb's prediction was only off by a few minutes. Boswell and Aubert arrived in their skiff, and the artist had just kissed Thomas on both cheeks.
"From Oceana," he laughed.
"A reminder to come back to the cove in one piece."
Thomas clapped a hand on Aubert's shoulder, and then turned to the sound of someone coming up from behind. It was one of A'ata's warriors, a tall, shirtless fellow, wearing not much more than a somber expression and a leaf garland headpiece. Thomas sighed when he saw that the young man was holding a pearl knife and a piece of fabric in one hand. Boswell raised his eyebrows.
"Another invitation."
McNabb grunted as the warrior dropped the fabric and then flicked the knife to the ground, pinning the printed cloth into the red dirt.
"You will meet A'ata in the field after the midday meal tomorrow," said the warrior, "where you will compete in a wrestling match in the manner of our ancestors. Until then, I shall stay by your side to assure you do not run away."
Thomas was about to answer when Chief Varua stepped up.
"Your presence will not be necessary," he said to the young man in a stern tone. "Colonel Scoundrel is a great warrior in his nation. He will do the honorable thing. Now, return to A'ata and tell him what I have said, and also tell him that his actions bring shame upon our village." "But," began the warrior, Varua's eyes flashed. "Go now, or take your canoe and leave our village."
The rebuked warrior left the group and walked quickly down the beach.
"I do not wish to cause strife among your people, Chief Varua," said Thomas.
"And yet that is exactly what you have done, Colonel," Varua replied. "A'ata sees himself as my successor, and he is probably right. My people respect him, and he is the natural choice to take on my duties when I die. After he thrashes you tomorrow, his succession will be guaranteed."
"With respect, Chief Varua, you should not dismiss Thomas's chances against A'ata," said Aubert. "The match may not go the way you think."
"That is the only way it can go," chuckled Varua. "No man has ever come close to besting A'ata in the games, especially at wrestling. God willing, Colonel Scoundrel's neck will not yet be broken when I call an end to the combat just before A'ata sends him to meet his ancestors."
Varua nodded to the men and walked away. A cooling afternoon breeze drifted down from the craggy volcanic peaks that ringed the village, and a group of children playing with hoops and sticks raced past and disappeared down the sandy beach. Boswell and McNabb took seats at the stone table and were joined a moment later by Aubert and Thomas. The artist raised one arm and waved to the women in the cook shack, who knew Aubert and had no doubt what he was asking for.
"Am I the only one who thinks it's time to uncork a few bottles?" he said with a grin.
The feast began just as the sun was dipping below the western horizon. The sky was clear, the air balmy, and a soft breeze rustled the palms around the village's common area. Thomas estimated there were over 200 people scattered around, some seated at tables, others on logs or stones. Children carted platters of savory roast pork, broiled fish, breads, fruits, and cheeses from group to group, while young men and women poured wine, rum punch, and fresh creek water from clay pitchers. Where most of the villagers had been dressed in some version of Western clothing earlier in the day, tonight the village was a sea of traditional costumes. Men wore woven reed waist belts above loincloths with grass skirts front and back that left most of their legs bare. They fashioned leafy garters around their knees and above their elbows, and many wore elaborate headgear of tightly woven plant materials and dried flowers that swept up above shoulder capes fashioned with reeds and trimmed with seashells and red seaweed. Varua wore a woven hat shaped like a chimney that towered 3 feet above his head. It was festooned with dried flowers and featured intricate triangular-shaped designs. Most of the women wore pareu skirts made with a rectangular piece of cotton fabric. The fabric was wrapped around their waists and tied securely, with the excess fabric draped to one side or at the front, sometimes with intricate knots or pleats. All the women and girls, including toddlers, wore flowers and greenery crowns on their heads, and many also wore flowered strands around their necks. A half dozen bonfires blazed around the compound, and together with the light from dozens of pitch torches, the area was bathed in flickering shades of rich ochre and gold. Aubert, who had been deep in his cup for hours, was exhilarated by the sights and smells of the festivities. "Who among you would not wish to be an artist tonight to capture these colors? These?" He paused as a stunning young woman danced past him, with her hips swiveling left and right and up and down to the rhythm of the drum music. "These magnificent human forms," he finally finished. "God help me, but I must paint now." He stood unsteadily, tried to begin walking to where his paints and easel were waiting, and then collapsed back down on his seat.
"Tomorrow, my friend,"
said Boswell, as he helped the artist settle back before turning to McNabb and Thomas.
"He is right about painting this extraordinary scene. I will sketch what I can from memory in the morning. But nothing can compare to being here in the middle of all of this as it is happening."
He swept his arm around the compound, where dancers, musicians, servers, and tumblers whirled and children laughed as they chased chickens and dogs in, around, and under the tables. Thomas heard what his friend was saying, but he wasn't paying attention. His gaze was fixed across the compound and through the flames of the bonfire to the table where Keani sat with several friends. Her pareu and woven top were dyed fuchsia and purple and decorated with gold stars. Atop her head she wore a crown of red, purple, yellow, and green flowers and leaves, which flowed into a double strand that encircled her neck and trailed down below her partially visible breasts. Like Thomas, Keani was ignoring the conversation around her. She, too, was staring through the flames, directly into his eyes. Boswell watched as the famous American soldier and the sister of a powerful Tahitian chieftain locked eyes in a lover's firelit embrace. McNabb was right, the naturalist thought. Tragedy was bubbling up from deep inside the volcano, and the coming eruption could could only unleash a river of death and loss.